One of the things that I can say, as I read it, this doesn't happen very often, but as I read it, once in a while I would find myself laughing out loud.
Okay.
Now this is very unusual because usually I'm a solitary reader and I keep it stored inside, but there were some very funny things that I enjoyed.
I'm glad to hear that.
Particularly how you brought everything to a conclusion at the end shows that... showing, as I think maybe you'll be able to state in a little more detail for me in a minute, that love is not just sex. I want to find out a little bit about you, because you certainly had a long, varied, and controversial career, and I assume that some of your career was reflected in your nonfiction book about your family, but when the publicist sent over the biographical data about you, it didn't say very much about you. And so I'd like to find out a little bit about you and some of your background, and so I have a perspective about the kind of person you are, the type of person who would write a book like this, and some of the movies that you've written and so forth. You were born, of course, to your father was a very famous writer himself, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And during the 1920s, when I was growing up, he was really one of the best known names in the country, because he had a Sunday column that was syndicated in 150 newspapers, something as well. And the short stories then were published in Saturday Evening Post and Cosmopolitan and magazines like that. And he was extremely well known.
He was a New Yorker.
No, he was from Niles, Michigan, and was basically a Chicago newspaper man and columnist before we all moved to New York. My three brothers and I were all born in Chicago while he was working there on the Chicago Tribune.
Was he part of this Charles Hecht crowd?
Well, he was a little bit older than MacArthur and Hecht, just a few years. He knew both of them. They were just starting in Chicago about the time we left in 1919.
What paper was he with in New York?
In Chicago, on the Tribune. And he did a column called In the Wake of the News for about 6 or 7 years. It's a column that's still going in the Chicago Tribune. And he used to write about sports and about his family, and lots of dialogue scenes from the breakfast table at the four of us boys expressing our opinions at a very young age.
When he moved to New York, did he work on a paper here?
He moved to New York really to concentrate on fiction, and he helped the theater, but he continued this column, mm-hmm. which was, and matter of fact, it started, then he started to be syndicated when he came to New York, but he worked at home, he also did a comic strip for a couple of years. I mean, he wrote the text, a cartoonist, based on his character in You Know Me, Al, the baseball pitcher Jack Keefe.
Mm-hmm. He was particularly active in the 20s. In the 30s, too?
Well, he died in 1933, and he was quite sick the last couple of years of his life. He was only 48 when he died. But I would say the 20s... all through the 20s were really his heyday. The end of the decade, he and George Kaufman wrote a play, June Moon, which was quite a big hit on Broadway. And that had been my father's ambition, to get a successful play produced.
You were born in 1915.
Yes.
So you were...
I was only four when we made this trip from...
And
Chicago,
you were still relatively young when your father died, but you still must have recognized the fact at some point in your childhood that you were the son of a very famous father.
Yeah, well, I was 18 when he died, and I had already started college. Yes, I was aware of it. I remember asking him from something I'd read. I said, "Dad, are you a humorist?" And he would never be caught dead answering yes to a question like that. He said, that would be like saying, if somebody said, "What position do you play?" And I said, "I'm a great third baseman." He was saying he just wouldn't confess to the, or use himself the word humorist.
He wanted to break out of that mold or image, I would assume.
Well, he thought to say you were a humorist was a kind of self-conscious thing that carried a little bit of conceit with it, because it implied that you were a successful one. Whereas he never took his work very seriously.
Now, I can see that somebody saying, I'm a humorist, and somebody else says, "Well, I don't think you're very funny." So, where did you go to college?
I went to Princeton, but only for 2 years. I left at the end of 2 years, voluntarily.
Did you complete your college education?
No, I didn't. I went to work on a newspaper here in New York.
You were following in your father's footsteps then?
Well, as my father went one term to the Armour Institute of Technology in Chicago, and my oldest brother went a year to Harvard and a year to the Sorbonne, and my next oldest brother went 2.5 years to Harvard. I went 2 years to Princeton, and my youngest brother went 2.5 years to Yale. Nobody ever finished college.
Well, you add up all those years, it comes very close. So, what paper did you work for here?
The Daily Mirror, which was the...
tabloid, wasn't it?
The tabloid, yes. Very much an imitation of the Daily News. Never quite made the circulation or the general level of the news, but it was a Hearst paper. It was mostly known and probably mostly bought for Walter Winchell's column.
What was the heyday of the Mirror? What years was it the most prominent?
In the, I believe it started in the late 20s. It was quite prominent all through the 30s, but I think began to decline in the, I can't remember what year. I was out in Hollywood by then, and I can't remember when it actually folded.
It did go into the 40s, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
What did you do on the Mirror?
I was a general city news reporter.
That must have been an exciting period when there's so many newspapers. There must have been about a dozen papers.
Oh, yes, there were.
When I came to New York, and started working here, they still had the city news agency, which was a wire. We had wire reports.
Yes, I remember seeing
that. Of course, gone for a long time now, but and I used to do a lot of street reporting back in the late 60s here, but you don't see as many newspaper reporters covering these news conferences as you use. A lot of microphones,
no.
But not too many newspaper reporters. Must have been very exciting.
Yeah, I remember going to a news conference at Governor Herbert Lehman's New York apartment, where he introduced us to Thomas Dewey, whom he just imported from Michigan to be special rackets prosecutor. This was following the assassination of Dutch Schultz, which I also covered. And that was the year of the trial of Bruno Richard Hauptmann for the Lindbergh kidnapping, which, of course, to the Mirror and the News was the biggest story there was. It must have had, half the staff covering that trial.
Yeah. Well, when did you, you left the Mirror when? To go to
I only was on it a year. I met David Selznick through some family friends of my college roommate and my parents' former neighbor, Herbert Byard Swope. Had Selznick as a house guest, and I was there and met him, and Selznick was starting a new company and offered me a job in his publicity department. So I went to the coast when I was 20 years old.
20 years old, you already sold out. You left journalism to go into publicity. 20 years old.
Absolutely.
You got to be in your 40s to do that. 50s, and then you sell.
Well, he said the idea was I was going to train me in everything about the motion picture business, and but I would earn my keep by being in the publicity department. He gave me a screen test, among other things, and I never heard anything about it except he said you're going to be a writer.
I've seen your screen test. I'm going to make you part of my writing staff.
Right.
So, what happened? Did you indeed start? Obviously, you wrote many screenplays.
How did this evolution begin? Bud Schulberg was working as a reader in Selznick's story department, and while he was making a picture called A Star Is Born, the original production with Frederick March and Janet Gaynor, and he asked Bud and me if we wanted to try writing a couple of scenes for this picture. And then he used several of our scenes, and including the ending, which was later used in the James Mason, Judy Garland version of the same thing. And Dorothy Parker and her husband, Alan Campbell, who had written the screenplay, were very nice to us, and even Dorothy Parker tried to persuade Selznick that he should give us credit on the picture, which we didn't really deserve. But he said now we were writers, and gave us various projects to work on, but we found out he never read the scripts we wrote. Only again when he did a picture called Nothing Sacred, which Ben Hecht had written, and he and Selznick had a dispute over it. I was called in again on the ending.
Now, well, I've seen that recently. Tell me a little, what's the...
It was also done as a musical.
It was about the gangsters, wasn't it?
No, it was about woman played by Carol Lombard, who was supposed to be dying of radium poisoning. And it became a terrific newspaper story, and then they found out she wasn't really dying. And
I recognize it now. I have taped it because I believe it was on either Channel 13 not too long ago, or on Showtime, and I've taped it and put it aside to see it. It did sound interesting, but you actually worked on that one.
Yeah, the ending, the very last scene of the picture is. It was a very hard picture to end, and Selznick had after Ben Hecht left the lot, Selznick had George Kaufman and Robert E. Sherwood and Moss Hart and all sorts of people. He rushed copies of the script all over the country to try to think of an ending, and finally used the one that I had thought of.
Sure sounds like a funny way to put a movie together, doesn't it?
Yes. On Gone with the Wind, which he was preparing all the time I was working for him, he had 17 writers, including Scott Fitzgerald and Ben Hecht and Sidney Howard and a lot of other quite prominent.
Now, I understand Casablanca was a team effort, too, and you really wonder how movies like Gone with the Wind and Casablanca could survive so many cooks throwing material into the pot.
Well, finally, I know with Gone with the Wind, it was that they called when Selznick fired George Cukor as director and hired Victor Fleming. He called in Ben Hecht to do a rewrite, and Hecht didn't have time to read all these scripts that had been written. He didn't even have time to read the book. He just read the first script that had been written by Sidney Howard and rewrote from that in consultation with Selznick and Fleming. They would decide every day what he should write, and then Ben would sit down and dash it off. He was very quick. And so he wrote, it really should have been screenplay by Sidney Howard and Ben Hecht, and none of the other 15 writers, none of their work was used.
How long were you with Selznick?
I think two and a half years.
Then what happened?
Well, it finally became clear that nothing that we wrote was going to get done there. As I say, Selznick never had time to read it. Bud Schulberg once had to send a script by motorcycle courier to Palm Springs, where Selznick was, so he could read it immediately, but found out 6 months later that David still hadn't read it. So I instead accepted a job in the B-writing department, the small budget pictures at Warner Brothers, and with the idea that at least I would get something that would appear on the screen. But I immediately got pulled out of that into work on an A picture, which got changed completely, and very little of my work was used.
What picture was that?
I did get some experience. It was a picture called The Kokomo Kid, with an actor named Wayne Morris, about a prize fighter.
That one, I think, has been lost forever.
Yeah, oh, yes. It deservedly so. Actually, the although I did get credit on a few minor pictures, it wasn't until 1941, I think, that I really kind of broke out of that pattern. And that was a picture Michael Kanin and I wrote together called Woman of the Year. That brought Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy together, and was, of course, recently a musical on Broadway with Lauren Bacall. But we got very small credit on, but no money at all from the musical, because in those days you sold an original screenplay outright, and the studio became the copyright owner. So MGM collected the author's royalties from the. In the Broadway musical.
You brought us up to World War II. What did you do during the war?
I didn't do much because I did work for the Army Signal Corps for a while as a civilian writing training films, but I was not drafted because I already had two children by that time, and I tried for a lot of other jobs, including the OWI and other film units that were shooting in the Russian front and the Pacific front. But I was always turned down for political reasons. That's where I first ran across. In my own case, I first heard about this phrase that they use, a premature anti-fascist, which was what I was called in the...
You were publicly involved in politics, as opposed to other people in Hollywood who kept it private.
Yeah, I was some of that, but anybody who was, say, an anti-fascist during the Spanish Civil War was a premature anti-fascist in the FBI's judgment. And I had done work raising money for ambulances during that war. My closest brother was fought in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and was killed in 1938 in Spain. And we also worked on things like the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League and organizing the Screenwriters Guild and...
But you were not specifically blacklisted until the 50s.
It was 1947, where the hearings before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and the blacklist began for us in 47. For most of the people who were blacklisted, about 300 or more, it didn't begin until 51.
Now, were you weren't part of the Hollywood 10.
Yes.
You were part
I
of
was.
It. With Lester Cole?
Yes.
Yeah, Lester has been in, and is still very bitter about what happened. Very, very angry.
Yes.
I thought that, for some reason, I thought those hearings were somewhat later than 1947.
No, they were in fall of 1947.
Fall of 1947.
We didn't actually go to prison until 1950, because it was went up to the Supreme Court in the meantime.
Yeah. That. What a traumatic period that was, and such a... Yeah. You look back, it's such an injustice. You were not. Were you a member of the Communist Party?
Yes, I was.
You were a publicly member?
No. Virtually no one in Hollywood was, and in many other parts of the country where it meant the loss of a job, was publicly a member. But I was by no means all the people who were blacklisted were members of the Communist Party. I know of my own knowledge, I know many who weren't, but I had been for several years a member of the party.
What after this became common knowledge, you were cited for contempt, you found yourself blacklisted, what did you do to support yourself? How did you survive?
Well, at first, in the first 2.5 years before we went to prison, while there was, we thought we had a pretty good case in the courts, and so did so did some other people, and so we got jobs in Hollywood under the table, so without using our names, but people weren't too careful about hiring us, and for less money than we've been making before. And I also worked in Europe during that period. But after we got out of prison in 1951, the atmosphere had changed much for the worse. Senator McCarthy had come on the scene, who hadn't even found out about the Red Menace in 47, and the Rosenberg trial had taken place, and the whole atmosphere was much different, and then everything was closed down in Hollywood. We couldn't get jobs. I then, with another blacklisted writer, Ian McClellan Hunter, wrote television films which were shot in England by a producer who knew who we were and deliberately hired blacklisted writers. And then her name was Hannah Weinstein, sold these television series to American networks, but our names were never attached to them. But Hunter and I had three in a row, I think, the pilot films we wrote that were bought by networks and became popular children's television series. Mm-hmm. The first one we did was The Adventures of Robin Hood, starring an actor named Richard Green. And that was quite popular in this country.
At what point did you find the blacklist beginning to lift?
Well, it began to break down during the latter part of the 50s, partly as a result of various confusions and errors about Academy Awards. There was an Academy Award a nomination of a script that a blacklisted writer, Michael Wilson, had written, when it was nominated by the vote of the Academy members, the Academy changed its rules and said that no script was eligible, had been written by anybody who had refused to cooperate with the committee. So they just threw it out and had 4 nominees instead of 5. Then the very next year, a picture that Mike Wilson had actually co-written with Carl Foreman, The Bridge on the River Kwai, won the Best Screenplay Award. And just a few months ago, they finally, after both Mike and Carl were dead, their widows received the Oscars that they should have received back then. And also Dalton Trumbo had a story he had written under the name of Robert Rich, a picture called The Brave One, which won an Academy Award, and nobody stepped forward to receive it, and it became generally known that it was Trumbo's. And that started to make the whole thing be ridiculous. And in 1960, Trumbo had written a script of a picture called Spartacus for Kirk Douglas and Edward Lewis, and also for Otto Preminger, his adaptation of a book, Exodus. And Preminger decided to put Trumbo's name on it.
That's doubly risky, because Howard Fast wrote Spartacus, and he also went to...
Well, it was Exodus that was decided first by Preminger, and then Kirk Douglas decided that they might as well go ahead and put Trumbo's name on Spartacus.
So we move into the 60s and the 70s, and this time you're back in Hollywood turning out.
Yeah, by 62, Otto, whom I had worked for before, I was working for at the time of The Blacklist, announced he was hiring me for a job, but we never made the picture. Like the first credit I had, yeah, the first one that was a picture called The Cincinnati Kid with Steve McQueen, and it wasn't released till 65.
Mm-hmm. You've done a lot of writing since that time. You won two Academy Awards for your work.
Well, the first one was back, it was Woman of the Year, back in 42. At least MASH was the second.
The Robert Altman picture of MASH.
Right.
People get confused when they see that back on television. They see Donald Sutherland in it, and they can't figure out what's going on.
Yes, as a matter of fact, we probably lost a lot of television residuals because that wasn't shown much while the series was. The picture was not used. I mean, it was a very successful picture, and it would have been shown on television much more if it hadn't been for the series.
That was a revolutionary film, as it later, I think, applied to television, because it was such it treated the process of surgery with great candor. My wife happens to be a nurse, and much of what goes on in the operating room is filled with banter and sacrilege. And I think MASH reflected that. Did you have any personal to observe what goes on, or how were you so true to life with that?
Well, there had been a book, MASH, written by a surgeon in Maine who had been a member of such a MASH unit, and with a professional writer as a collaborator, he wrote this book about it. And when I...
Was that a fiction?
It was fiction. It was really more, not quite a novel, but a series of short stories about the same characters in this surgical
People
unit.
People forget then. I don't think I even knew that had been a book.
Yes. As a matter of fact, the way it became a movie was that the publisher, William Morrow, sent the galleys of the book to me to see if I would write a blurb for the jacket, because I had written a blurb for a friend of mine's book that had been published by Morrow, and they just thought I was a good blurb writer, and I thought it could be made into a movie, and I sold the idea to my friend Ingo Preminger, who took it to 20th Century Fox and sold it to them, and he was the producer. But on the subject of the surgical stuff, after we made the deal and bought the rights and so on, I went up to Maine and visited this surgeon who had written the book under the pseudonym Richard Hooker, and asked him a lot of questions. And then when the thing was actually being shot, there was a surgeon on the set. He was actually a heart specialist, but to advise about technical things. It was a great issue all the time whether we could deal with the surgical part and be... I had written in the script several times that this should look very bloody while this banter was going on. And Altman, who had the same attitude toward the material that I did, saw to it that that was done. And this technical advisor, surgeon, saw to it that it was done accurately. Even then, we weren't quite over the hill, because when the first showing up occurred in New York, and it was the first time the 20th Century executives here, 20th Century Fox executives here had seen it, Daryl Zanuck said after the showing, "Everybody meet in my office at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. We've got to cut out all that operating room gore." And So we were all extremely alarmed, and the next morning at 10 o'clock, he showed up and said, "Well, I've changed my mind about that. It turns out that Genevieve, who was a young French actress, Genevieve Gilles, that Zanuck was going around with then, I think she was in her very early 20s, and he was in his late 60s, that Genevieve had said to him afterwards that she liked the bloody scenes. So he had decided that was the young person's point of view.
Thank God for Nymphets. Right. At what point did you leave Hollywood?
I never went back there to live after we got out of prison in 1951. I just spent a few months there, and then went with my wife and children to Mexico City for a while, and then up to Connecticut where my mother had a place. And always from then on, I made trips to Hollywood to have conferences about a script and then come back east and do it. But I kept on. That was my major work.
Where's home base for you now? Where do you live now?
I have an apartment in Manhattan and a home in Weston, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. You were in prison for how long?
It was a one-year sentence.
Was it in Lewisburg?
What?
Where was it?
No, Lester Cole and I were at Danbury, Connecticut. But the others were spread around at different places.
How do you feel about it, looking back at this prison sentence and what happened to you so long ago? Are you still as embittered as Lester Cole is? Or have you reconciled the past somewhat?
I don't think so. I thought the whole case was pretty foolish at the time. I had really got involved in it because I thought we had a chance to make some constitutional progress and get a good decision out of it. But it seems to me that American history is full of a cycle of going from repression to much more liberal attitudes that ever since the Alien and Sedition Acts back in the 1790s, and there have been these alternate periods, and this was one of them. I think we may be heading into another one now. But I can't say that I was terribly bitter about the experience.
Do you still consider yourself a communist?
No.
You've outgrown it?
I suppose I do believe in some sort of socialism is a little more sensible than capitalism, but it's never been successfully carried out anywhere, so there's nowhere I can point to. I think that since the time I was a communist, two things, the invention of the nuclear bomb and the realization of how much man is doing to his environment, have between them seemed much more important issues to me than what kind of economic system we have. And those issues, with the possibility between them of the whole world being destroyed, kind of transcend all the other ones for me.
You registered to vote in the election? Any election, any presidential election?
Do I vote?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you vote as in a part of a, I'm not asking you what party, but as part of a major party now? Or?
Yes, I have voted minor parties of various ones, but I have recently, I think since George McGovern in 72, I think I've pretty much favored the Democratic candidate.
And from a Communist Party member to a Democratic Party member.
Neither one of them has seems to have the answers as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I have dwelt longer than I should have, probably. You're such a fascinating guy. I wanted to find out about some of your background a little bit. This brings us up to your second novel. Well, not quite. Actually, I think I should ask you a question about your first novel. That was called The Ecstasy of Owen Muir, 1954.
Yes.
That came at a time when you were you were still blacklisted during that time, weren't you?
Oh, yes. And as a matter of fact, that was the first thing I wrote after I got out of prison and before I started on these television series. And that was the first novel I had written. I had great difficulty getting it published in this country, and no difficulty at all getting it published in England, where the first prominent Orthodox publisher it was presented to accepted it. But here it was published under kind of left-wing auspices by a firm called Cameron and Kahn, distributed by something called the Liberty Book Club, which really was a left-wing club.
Did the novel have a political thrust?
Not really. It was about it was really about Catholicism in America. It was about the marriage between a born Catholic young woman and a converted Catholic young man, and dealing with the difference in attitudes of a born Catholic and a convert, the convert taking it much more seriously and literally than the born one. And it was mainly meant to be amusing. I found quite a few what seemed to me funny things about the discrepancy between these attitudes.
Well, that was 30 years ago. It took you 30 years to come up with a second novel.
Yeah.
Why so long?
Well, partly because what money I had left over from Hollywood had run out while I was writing The Ecstasy of Owen Muir, and I soon found that I wasn't going to make enough to support five children from that. And at that time, the opportunity to do these television series came up. So mostly I was devoted to the most lucrative way of earning a living for that period. Then I started mentioning a few years ago, I decided I didn't want to write for movies anymore because there's so many things that are beyond the control of the writer, and I did an article for The Nation in which I announced my retirement from movie writing, and have concentrated since on this book and a play that I've written, which is going to be have a staged reading this week up in Connecticut, with George Grizzard reading the leading part.
Well, for All for Love is the title of your new novel. It certainly is a sexy book.
Well, the subject led to that. The idea which I had of a microbiologist actually coming across a hormone that made people act as if they were in love. Not only people, but all animals who practice monogamy and devotion to one other member of the other sex. Yes, there's quite a bit of sex involved.
Well, we shouldn't really talk about that. I mean, after all, this is 1985, and sex is been repressed, and we just don't deal with it as publicly as we used to. Your interest, I think, indicated some interest in conservation, and of course you talk about the bounties of the wildlife, the coyotes that were initially used in order to extract this hormone. And it does. You also picture these animals in a very interesting way, as if they had almost had human attributes. You gave them names The coyote, apparently, I didn't know this, apparently they have a real family structure.
Oh, yes. All members of the coyote and wolf family do. There was a book that interested me by Farley Mowat a few years ago about his own experiences studying wolves in Canada, which was later made into a low-budget film. And he found out, observing wolves, that they had schools where they taught the wolf cubs how to hunt and how to stalk, and that they were very faithful to their love mates, and apparently had a very full kind of family life.
One of the funniest parts of the novel is, I guess, in the lighthouse, where the hero of your novel, whose name has escaped, Jeremy, has taken a container of the love hormone, which is called
eroticin,
and is trying to get his ex-wife to consume it. And so there are a lot of farcical things. The similar scene at Camp David, where he's crawling out the window, and it's very funny. I think there's only one stretch where there's an overtly political passage or two, and that's where the incumbent president is described. But I don't think you have too much in terms of politics in it, except as we get to the end, where the president is about to have his summit with the new head of state of the Soviet Union. Then you bring us to new uses for the hormone.
Yes, I had established that there is really very little difference between love between the sexes and love generally in the species, that the kind of love which the Greeks used to talk about as opposed to spiritual love or agape, this erotic love really is applies within families, with the same sex, with things completely removed from sexual relationships, that there's very little difference between, say, a mother's son kind of love and man for a woman. And so I think there's one point where I have a character, a housekeeper working for Jeremy, who falls in love with a statue of Jesus as a result, and goes off to become a nun. So in the end, this is used to bring the Soviet and American delegations into greater harmony about nuclear weapons.
Now, it's certainly a funny novel. I hope that we'll be able to get some more from you. I mean, 30 years between novels, that's a long time, and I don't think we can go another 30 years. So.
Well, I don't expect to. I'm getting to be 70 this year, and it would be...
Yeah, you got plenty of time to turn out more, though.
Yes, but not at 30-year gaps.
No, don't do that. Well, you're certainly an entertaining guy, and it's a real privilege meeting you. The book, I thought, was very funny, and I enjoyed reading it very much.